listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
How would you like to die? Asking patients that question is not easy for most doctors. In fact, most of us, doctors and patients alike, prefer to avoid the topic completely. Vijay Periyakoil, director of Stanford's Palliative Care Education and Training, says this needs to change. In April, she penned an essay for the New York Times in which she called for a role reversal in talking about end-of-life issues and encouraged patients to start that conversation themselves. She wrote, "Without these conversations, doctors don't know what the patient's goals are for living their last days. What are their hopes, wants, needs, and fears? Do they want to die at the hospital connected to a machine? Do they want to die at home?" To get these conversations started far and wide, Dr. Periyakoil launched the Stanford Letter Project to campaign to empower all adults to take the initiative to talk to their doctors about what matters most to them at life's end. I'll talk to Dr. Periyakoil about the project and why it's so important for patients to take the initiative and tell their physicians about how they want to spend their final days. But before we talk with her, let's hear from one of the letter writers.
Lo que es más importante para mí. I do not want artificial liquid feeding. I do not want to spend my last days in a hospital. I want to be pain-free. I want to die at home. I accept to be on a breathing machine only if it is needed to perform a particular treatment which could improve my health soon. What to do when my family wants you to do something different than what I want for myself? I want you to override my wishes as my family knows best. I will share a copy of this letter to each of my sons so that they know what are my wishes at the end of my life.
Vijay, thank you for joining me in One-to-One. I wanted to start. I mentioned in the intro that you had a provocative op-ed in the New York Times not long ago in the spring. And provocative in that you said, the first paragraph really grabbed me. You said patients and families need to lead their end-of-life decision-making and that it can't be left to healthcare providers because if it is, it won't happen. Why won't it happen? What's the disconnect?
It is not even that it won't happen. Data so far show that it's not happening. 2.6 million Americans die every year, and very few of them get to talk to their doctor about their end-of-life wishes, get to weigh in and in terms of where they want to die and how they want to be cared for. Looking at our own state in California, only 13% of people 65 or over have completed advance directives. In fact, getting advance directives completed is one of the key indicators that Secretary Diana Dooley is working on.
Diana Dooley, California Health
California.
Services.
Yes, it's one of the key indicators because the level of completion is so low. And a lot of times, I think patients and families are, understandably, waiting for the doctors to lead them. For example, when you're 65 and you need to get your pneumovax, you don't need to know about it. Your doctor is going to tell you about it and they're going to give the shot to you. In a similar fashion, I think patients and families might be thinking that the doctor is going to initiate end-of-life conversations. It is not that the doctor cannot, but data show that it's not happening. And so if patients and families were to wait for this non-event, then the risk for them is very high because they will never get to have these discussions, never get to voice where and how they want to die. And therefore, the system default will take over. And the current system default is to offer everyone every high-intensity treatment, irrespective of the wisdom of doing so and irrespective of what the patient and family wants.
So the effort that California, Diana Dooley, you mentioned her, is that she's the head of human resources or the head of health for the state of California. What is she, who would be impacted and who are they trying to impact? Is it everyone who goes into the hospital? Is it a certain age? Who should have a directive?
At some level, if you look at a population science perspective or take that approach, I would argue that anyone 18 and over should have an opportunity to complete the advanced directives. It may not be relevant to them. One of the ways I frame this is weigh in on your fate before you weigh in on the nation's fate. So before you vote very first time, you could actually decide what you want to see happening for yourself. In reality, I think anytime anyone has any chronic illness, and chronic illness is diabetes, it's high blood pressure, and we know that most Americans, most of us, if things go well, we are going to die of a chronic illness. Meaning, if you die acutely, either you have a massive heart attack and you keel over, or you have a stroke and you keel over, or you get run over by a truck. Most of us, if things go well, will hopefully die with some chronic illness as we get older. That's what we've seen over and over again. So anytime anyone has a chronic illness would be a great trigger to complete your advanced directives.
Tell me again, the trigger for a directive. Who should have a directive?
All adults should be able to complete their advanced directives. When people are younger, the issues related to end of life seem less relevant. So in reality, anyone who has any chronic illness, any of the big Cs, cancer, COPD, heart failure, congestive heart failure, any chronic illness should be a trigger to complete advanced directives. A lot of times people feel that they can wait, but the issue is it's always too early until it's too late.
But it's so complicated. You know, I mean, I say complicated in that, you know, most people don't know where, what an advanced directive is, where they would go to find out about advanced directive. So let's start from just education. How do you raise awareness about the need for advanced directives?
We've been actually starting at the level of high school. So we have a program by which we are working with local schools and educating the students there about healthy, successful aging. And one of those aspects is advanced care planning. And actually, our students are working within their family, within their community, within the seniors to complete advanced directives. Your point is well taken. If you look at the California advanced directive document, there's a lot of medical legal jargon. So even patients who are best intentioned look at the document, look at the first page, and then their eyes just glaze over. And so they postpone it until it becomes too late. One of the things that we've been trying to implement is how can we simplify this issue by asking questions in just regular English in a way that people can tell us what matters most to them. And once we know that, then the next step would be to take that and convert that into a filled out advanced directive form. So we ask normal people normal English questions. They tell us what they want. And then we use the data to fill out this medical legal form is what we are working on right now.
What about the responsibility maybe of healthcare systems? I mean, when you go on to make an appointment with your physician that pops something when you do an online appointment that says, do you have an advanced directive? I mean, it's pretty significant and pretty large and pretty overwhelming in a sense to really institutionalize this, I would think, on a large scale. So how do you scale this up to really have a large impact across the country?
While it might be somewhat painstaking and tedious to do this, to not do it is too risky. To your question, about 20 years ago, I think actually precisely in 1991, the Patient Self-Determination Act, which was law passed by Congress, was meant to do this, by which every hospital or any institution that got federal funding was supposed to offer, which we do, a patient an opportunity to complete advanced directives. But there is no mandate. It's just that you're supposed to offer, and so it gets put aside. I think right now, because of the demographic imperative, as the population is aging and as people are aging with chronic illness, there is a sort of a societal conscious about how we need to do this better. I think we need to normalize this just as we do preventive care in terms of immunizations. We routinely do that. This needs to be something that is routine. And if it is done as a due process, in terms of your interaction with the healthcare system, then it becomes less threatening and people will be able to think about it in a proactive fashion upstream. So typically what happens now? People wait until the very last minute when the patient is in the intensive care unit, they are not able to voice their opinion anymore. The family has never thought about it. No one really knows what the patient wants. And so everyone is sort of guessing in the dark. And while families are making this very difficult decision, the current default is to keep the patient in the intensive care unit with high intensity treatment. That's the default. And this goes on for a while until the family is able to make a decision. If you talk to most patients, and there is a lot of data that shows this, this is not what patients want. Most people, including me, want to die gently and naturally at home, surrounded by family.
And you did research that actually said that physicians, you know, the majority of physicians overwhelmingly want to die at home, and yet they're not able to talk about that. You know, your research reported that 99.9% of physicians reported barriers to conducting end-of-life discussions, 80% rating them as very challenging. So why is it so hard for physicians to have these discussions with their patients? If they're dealing with a patient who is chronically ill, who's looking at end of life, why is it so tough?
I think there are several factors. One important one is we don't train doctors to have these conversations. These are very sensitive, difficult conversations with a lot of intense emotion. We don't train doctors to do it, but we expect them to naturally be good communicators. We also don't factor in time for them to do it. So there is not a clinical encounter where you get 20 minutes or 40 minutes, depending on how long the conversation is, to be able to have these conversations. There is no time to do it. There's no training, but we expect them to do an amazing job without giving any of the resources.
A physician's training is about cure, about health. So that is sort of counter to this notion of helping someone prepare for the end, right?
That is really a very valid point. And as medicine has become more and more complex, medical school training is still the same length, and there is more and more information that they have to master within that short time that they have. And so, as you pointed out, because the bias is towards the next best cure that is available, which is extremely important, this sort of slips down in the agenda and doesn't get done.
You deal with chronically ill patients in the clinic. And I wondered if you could talk about some instances that you've seen play out in the clinic where patients do not have directives and some of the family dynamics that play themselves out and may be chaotic. And on the other hand, when people do have directives, how that may unfold into sort of a natural, perhaps even a calming end.
So when the patient has not had any conversation with the family about this, the challenge is that at some point in any chronic illness, the patient will stop mentating, meaning they will not be able to make decisions for themselves anymore. At which point, the surrogate decision maker, if there is one, is activated. In many families, they haven't even decided who the surrogate decision maker is going to be. Let's just assume for a minute that there is a patient and this patient has designated a surrogate in making decisions. What the surrogate is supposed to do is they are metaphorically supposed to take off their head and put on the patient's head and think like the patient. But that's not what happens. The surrogate loves the patient so much, they cannot even think of living on without their loved one. And therefore, instead of making a decision that the patient would have made for themselves, they will actually say, please offer more treatment because I'm hoping that my loved one will make it out of the...
So they basically overrule the director.
They do. So this is one ironic situation where the people who really love you a lot can hurt you because they don't listen to you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, in my own family, I had a circumstance unfold like you're talking about. My sister was in an accident. She fell, crushed her skull, bled out. She was in a coma for a year. Her family, basically, she didn't have a directive. You know, she was basically on life support. She had gone through a number of codes several times. So, you know, she was faced with, and to me, to see this person, you know, in a rehab facility, a freckle of what she was, that's not how she wanted to live her life. And yet, you know, when I would talk to my wife about it or others, they were like, well, who are you to play God, you know, of making a decision you know, maybe this isn't the right way for my sister to end her life like this, just withering away in a rehab bed. And it was one of those things that, you know, was pretty painful to look at and without a directive. And so you see how this unfolds and you see how the complexity of families, I mean, any slight movement she would have would give her family sort of hope that that was a breakthrough when it really wasn't. When a neurologist would say to me, that's just involuntary movement. It has nothing to do with her ability to, you know, recover. And it really was quite wrenching to see how this unfolded. And I think that that's probably happens thousands of times in hospitals across the country today. And so what you're trying to do is, how do we come to some common sense way to change the dynamic?
Yes, I would say, first of all, I'm so sorry that you had that really traumatic experience in your family that must have been stressful to everyone. In terms of what we need to do, I think we need to free dying from the hospitals, meaning we need to take back dying. Dying is a social event, just like birth, just like marriage. And back in the 60s, I've read a lot about how the birth process prior to that was very natural. And then suddenly the birthing process moved into the hospital. The father was not allowed to be there in the birthing suite. Everything was medicalized, over-medicalized. And in a similar fashion, we are doing the same thing with dying now. The question is, how can we make the patient the quarterback of their care? And how can we be the coaches instead of us taking over their life without talking to them and making the default happen? So that's kind of where we are. And our efforts have been trying to empower the patient and tell them, listen, this is your life. You need to tell us how we can best provide care for you. And here are some tools. Please use this to tell us what it is that we should and shouldn't be doing. And don't be surprised if your family is not willing to talk to you about it, because just the thought of your death is too painful to them. So expect resistance. No one will want to talk to you about it because they love you too much. But you're the one at risk, and you need to safeguard yourself by having these conversations, by doing the documentation ahead of time. Patients and families need to know that if they are at risk of anything, they are at risk of overtreatment, they are at risk of over-medicalized dying. Our bias currently, and I am very much within the system, so it's not those doctors out there, it's me and my colleagues. We went to med school and we trained because we really enjoy keeping people alive and healthy as long as we possibly can. We want to prolong life. But somewhere in there is a tipping point where we start prolonging the dying process. The patient is dying, and so now we are not prolonging life with quality anymore. We are prolonging the dying process. But because of our training, we often find ourselves incapable of stopping that. Even though if you stop me and ask me what it is that I'm doing, I'll be able to tell you that the situation is really prolonging the dying process, but we still are geared to do that.
And just so we make a point, this is not right to die movement. This is not the right to die movement. We're not talking about that. We're talking about something quite different.
Not at all. I mean, you're absolutely right. This is not about the right to die movement. What I'm talking about is, with any chronic illness, if you have a crisis, if you go into the hospital, people like me, doctors like me, will do everything we possibly can to prolong your life as much as we possibly can. So patients and families need to know that if they are at risk of anything, they are at risk of overtreatment. They are at risk of having procedures and treatments done to them that they may not want, because at some point the treatments become very burdensome, but we will still continue to offer them because that's what we are trained to do. So at some level, for us to dial back on what we are doing itself is counterintuitive for us as doctors. And so people are not at risk of being undertreated in this country, and there's tremendous amount of evidence to back that up. So this fear of death panels is really, it's not borne out in the data.
It's political. It's not reality.
Yeah, in my practice, when I look at the patient in front of me, it takes a lot of restraint for me to not order the next CT scan, to not consult another colleague. Whereas it is very hard for me to say, what matters to you? And how can I provide the care that fulfills the wishes that you have? Because most often that is, I want to be with my family. I want to be in a home-like environment, which means I don't get to do all the treatments and procedures that I'm trained to do. And doctors are actually pretty attached to their patients. It also means that I won't get to see this patient anymore. And I'm attached to them. And so the more closer we are or the more connected we are to the patient, the harder it is for us to let go. And so our way of not letting go is to continue to do these treatments to patients.
How did you get to this point where you personally decided that this is something that you would put some passion behind, some power behind, some authority? What got you there?
I have, you know, been witness to so many patients who have been subjected to burdensome treatments. I remember a situation where a patient who was 95 or 96 years old, who had severe osteoporosis, had a fracture related to that. And this patient always wanted to die gently and naturally. And at that point, he was 96 years old, really not in a position to be able to tolerate any major surgery. The surgeons were reluctant. They could operate on the patient. They did operate on the patient, but they were not really wanting to do that because everyone was concerned about whether the patient would be able to withstand the surgery and whether we were actually causing more suffering, which is actually what ended up happening. The family insisted because societal thinking is when someone has a broken bone, you don't let it go. Doesn't matter who it is. And so we did do the surgery for the patient. The patient was in severe pain postoperatively, even though when someone has a major surgery, they're going to be in pain. But he also did not do well after the surgery and actually ended up dying a few days after the surgery. If we had not done the surgery, the patient would still have died, perhaps lived a few more days than he actually did, but it would have been with much more comfort and dignity instead of having to go through the ICU, not to be with his family, and still die. That's just one example, and I've seen so many patients. We did a study a few years ago looking at patients with metastatic cancer who are admitted to the intensive care unit and found a fair number of patients, and we evaluated the quality of their dying using a standard checklist and found that the quality of dying was very poor for these patients. So I've seen so many of these patients, and you go into medicine to help people, and at some point you stop helping people. And at that point, the best way to help them is to not do any more treatments, just to support them, to just be there and take a supportive role, focus on their comfort. And that's very hard for us to do because we are not trained to do that. So it's almost like a practice of personal discipline to say, here is the problem, here is the fix. It's simple, but it's difficult to implement. But how do we do this? And how can we empower the patient to be in the middle of all this, right in the center, so they get to weigh in on their own care?
I would imagine that one of the things that further complicates people making decisions about directives are cultural, social, religious issues and how they play into this. Can you talk a bit about that?
Definitely, because death is a very social family event. Culture and religion play a big part, or at least that's what we've found in our research work. Doctors become very uncomfortable when patients from ethnic communities ask for things like, please don't tell my grandmother that she has cancer. When faced with something like that, doctors just don't know what to do and they are stunned. And so the conversation stops right there. From the patient family point of view, a lot of times there is not a clear decision maker in the family. For example, in many ethnic families, decision making is done as a group. So even though it may be about the patient is not the one making the decisions. The family member might be the ones, it's by consensus. Multiple people are involved. Everyone has to weigh in. They have to come to a consensus before a decision can be made. And that makes it very complex. In some faith systems, people believe that death is something that has to be in the power, or the decision about death, to restate it, has to be done by God and by a higher power, and mere humans have no business orchestrating the dying process. So that's one thing that I hear often. Another one is where people will say they believe in redemptive suffering. And if a patient is in the ICU and if they are suffering or if they are in pain, this is one last opportunity to redeem themselves so that they can have a better fate after death.
And here's a very clear directive that touches on religion.
What matters most to me at the end of my life, I want to invite the Buddhist monk to give me a blessing before I die. I don't want to be on breathing machines. I don't want any artificial liquid feeding. My culture, the family is very, very important to all of us. So the entire family make the decisions.
So these are belief systems. And the challenge is, how do you support patients within those belief constructs? One thing that you mentioned earlier is when you were talking about your sister, you said that something like, who are you to play God? And so the issue to me is not that we are playing God. The issue is we are putting up artificial barriers to natural dying. So in that sense, if dying is natural and if it's meant to be, and if we are stopping that by putting in a lot of artificial barriers, that too is orchestrating the dying process.
When you're facing your own end of life, yours, how do you want to die?
To me right now, my court status is full court. What I mean by that is, if something were to happen to me right now, because I have family, I have responsibilities, I want my colleagues to attempt resuscitation. I do want to be in the ICU as long as it is something that is reversible. But if I were to have a terminal illness which is not reversible, I don't want to burden my family. I don't want them to have to take care of me. And in a situation like that, I would want to die gently and naturally. Ideally, I would like to die at home surrounded by family, but I also recognize that that may not be feasible. And so if it means that if I am in a care facility, in a group home, where the burden is decreased on my family and I end up dying there, so be it. Ideally, I'd like to die at home, but having a person die at home, you need a lot of support. And if that's too much of a burden on my family, I don't want to burden my family.
Vijay Periyakoil, thank you. And now we're going to close out with one more testament, one more letter.
Kính thưa bác sĩ, gần đây tôi đã nghĩ đến những vấn đề về cuộc sống cuối đời của tôi. Dear doctor, I have been thinking about end-of-life issues lately. I know that you are very busy and may find it awkward to talk to me about my end-of-life wishes. You may feel that it is too early for me to have this conversation with you. So I am writing this letter to clarify what matters most to me. Right now, what matters most to me is God, my family, relatives, close friends, and my girlfriend. If one day I am no longer capable of making medical decisions for myself and people in my family, I would like my sister to make those medical decisions for me. If they are not available at that time, I would like my parents or best friend to make end-of-life decisions for me. I do not want to die at home and be a burden to my family. What I do want is to be pain-free, to be on comfort, hospice care, and to die gently and naturally. If my pain and distress are too difficult to control, please sedate me and make me sleep with sleep medicine, even if this means I may die sooner.
Thank you to the letter writers Sandra Escalante, Kin Chan, and Chai Mei. To write your own letter, visit med.stanford.edu/letter.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One-to-One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.